From the Senate Interim Committee on Education and General Government today. Hello, good morning, and welcome. We'll start off with this committee's favorite subject, full-day kindergarten, and bring the crew up, Karen, Don, Brenda, everyone else that's on the task force. We created this implementation committee. They've been working hard all year long. Some of us have attended some of those meetings. I know Senator Cruz, who's going to be here shortly, is has been playing a role there. And today is the day they give us their recommendation. We have their recommendation already in your packets, if you should see it in the form of an LC draft. But I mostly, at this point, want to express my gratitude for you guys put in some long days. Those agendas would go from, I'd look at those agendas, and they'd be from 8 to 4. And they met, maybe a dozen times over the year with some really committed people, cross-section of teachers and administrators and various members of the education committee, people who really do education on the ground. So giving up the time to do that, we appreciate very much. And forward to your report, and we'll all try as hard as we can to advocate for it next year.
Thank you.
Go ahead and start off with your names. And
sure.
Give us your report.
My name's Karen Twain. I'm the chair of the committee, and was a principal in Tiger Twalton, and now I've moved to a director position. Most recently, I was principal at Metzger Elementary School.
Good name.
Yeah, it was definitely named after you. And
if I could interrupt,
sure.
Just on just that note, because you gave me the opening there, was Metzger was School of the Year about 3 years ago.
We received the Closing the Achievement Gap Award for 4 years in a row, which was the most, I believe, of any school.
And your decision to go to full day kindergarten some years prior to that was catalyst.
That was, we believe, the reason that we were able to, for the most part, close the achievement gap and consequently get some recognition for it.
Okay. All right. Sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead. I'll let us introduce you.
Oh, I'm Brenda Lewis. I work for the Teaching and Learning Department in Beaverton School District. I am an administrator for K-8 Title I programs and all special programs. I would like to add what Karen said. I'm also a former principal in Beaverton. I was a principal at Barnes Elementary and Beaver Acres Elementary. Both were distinguished schools by the U.S. Department of Education and the Oregon State Department of Education. Both programs also had full-day kindergarten, and I think that was a significant avenue for student achievement in both of those schools.
Don Grotting, current superintendent of David Douglas School District, and prior to that I was at the Nissa School District. Also, our entire district, as well as our elementary school, was identified for closing the achievement gap, and I attribute the number one change for that from taking three failing schools to opening up and having full-day kindergarten in the Nissa School District.
So it's probably not a surprise that all three of us and many other people in the state are very passionate about this particular topic. We began to work on the Senate Bill 44 about a year ago. As Senator Haas mentioned, we had broad representation. If you look at one of our pages and talks about the different people who were on the committee, we had parents, OEA and OSBA were represented, some of our legislators, administrators, teachers, early intervention, folks within the prison authority. It was a wide range of people, which was really nice to have. We had some rich discussion, and with the 14 committee members, we were able to come up with a proposal that's in front of you. Our charge was to aid and advise legislative assemblies, school districts, and the public charter schools in developing and providing a full-day kindergarten by the 2012-2013 school year. That's upon us, and that's probably not how it's going to go, but we have a proposal for you today. I think that most everyone agrees with research to back it up that full-day kindergarten is a good idea, and we need it as soon as possible. Anymore, it's really not if, it's when this will happen. And all three of us, and again, people throughout the state, have anecdotes to back this up. If you have the proposal in front of you, if you look at the last page, this is data from my school. It's math curriculum-based measures. And if you look at the chart, I don't even have to tell you which kids received full-day kindergarten and which did not. You look at that, clearly our fourth and fifth graders, this is a fall measure, did not receive full-day kindergarten. And you look at our first, second, and third grade scores, they were outstanding. It gave us a place to start. It's hard to provide intervention and help for kids when 90% of your kids aren't making it. So full-day kindergarten did make a difference for us. I spoke to one of our teachers yesterday, a first-grade teacher, who told me that last year was the first year we hadn't had full-day kindergarten. She said it's a different world. It's slower. The kids came in really with very little. Half-day kindergarten boils down to 2.5 hours. And that's not enough time to really get some good instruction in for kids. We're looking ahead now, and we know that we need to spend on the front end of things if we want to decrease dropout rates and the achievement gap. Full-day kindergarten will help our students be ready for the new diploma standards and be college and career ready. Making the investment up front is a better use of dollars when the budget is tight, and as we know, it is. You'll notice in here today that great attention has been paid to equity. We want all our students in Oregon to have access to full-day kindergarten and consequently reap the benefits from it. So let me let Brenda give you a little bit more information along those lines.
Thanks. Currently, we have 96 Oregon school districts who are offering some sort of full-day kindergarten program. As Karen said, the Oregon diploma standards have become more rigorous, and as a result, we need to find ways to capture time for students that need the additional time for learning, and full-day kindergarten is a good start for students. And the state has identified learning targets for kindergartners in the state of Oregon, and teachers really struggle to provide equity in a 2.5-hour kindergarten program each day. There's not enough time to differentiate instructions between not only students who are struggling learners, but students who come into kindergarten with high proficiencies in math and reading. And in a 2.5-hour program, it's a huge challenge to try to differentiate the instruction for those students. Also, parents willingly are paying now for full-day kindergarten because they understand that this is a value-added component for their child's education. Districts who have initiated full-day kindergarten programs have seen a return on that investment, and it's measured by increased academic achievement for their students. Mm-hmm. And as Karen said, investment on the front end for public education really is a better leverage of taxpayer dollars versus having to put dollars in on the upper end in terms of programs that recapture dropouts or on-the-job training for students who did not graduate. Cost of the fund, cost of course 100 courses in college for students who graduate but are not college and career ready, and then the state incarceration rate for children who do not graduate from school.
We drew straws to who was going to have to talk about funding, and I lost. I'll just reiterate what Brenda said. Doing this will cost more money, but I would challenge everyone that it would be the single most important strategy to not only improving the opportunity for kids to meet the third grade benchmark, but a chance to revamp the entire K-12 system with rigor, and it would end up decreasing graduation dropout rates, improving the opportunity for language acquisition, and especially improving the opportunity to close the achievement gap for children of color and children of poverty. I know this firsthand. I talked about NISA. We were approximately 65% Latino, and our full-day kindergarten was responsible for all of our kids, close to 90% meeting the benchmarks by the third grade. Without a doubt, it will make the most important difference to revamping our K-12 system. Currently, as you know, all school districts are publicly funded for half weighting. And it's also important to know that close to already 50% of our districts are involved in full-day kindergarten in some way, and over a third of our students. So everybody out there knows it's the right thing to do. It's going to make the most important positive impact on our system. I just can't say enough as far as providing the equity that's needed to move the education system in Oregon forward. Thank you.
In terms of capital, which is a big part of implementation, we believe that the capital issues really do not lie within the state. That's not the issue that you need to undertake. This is really a local thing. In order to do this, you need to prioritize within buildings and make use of every bit of space. It's easy to walk through a building and say it's full. I definitely was in that situation. And not until I started to sort of reprioritize and look within our building of how we could move things around did we find some space for full-day kindergarten. And one of the things that could happen should this go through is that we could provide some assistance through visitations and conversations with administrators and teachers in terms of how it's done successfully within the state. In my building, we moved some classrooms around in terms of ELL and special ed. We created a makeshift classroom in a pod. We did some things that were definitely out of the box, but that's what we need to do is be creative, and that is the one thing I believe educators are pretty good at. The 5 years that we've set out in the proposal would allow for districts to start making plans and possibly floating bonds if it was necessary. We've put in here that the bonding for capital improvements, the Measure 68, all we would ask is that, should that come up and work out, that full-day kindergarten is kept in mind. So should there be money, that construction for full-day might be a possibility, something to be considered.
But on that point, if I can interrupt again,
sure.
Karen, I think that's important. To lift up what you just said, your story with Metzger was elementary.
Facilities
person said, okay, we don't have the space, or it would require all this space. And then you, the principal, walked around and said, well, what if we joined these two rooms? How did that?
It is critical, because if you look at the big picture, it looks like too much to bite off. You know, if you talk to administrators and parents, they say, our schools are full. We don't have any room. But I have seen firsthand, not only in my school, but in some other schools that truly, in fact, my own children's school in Beaverton, as they moved things around, just shifted, they were able to create space, and so were we. It wasn't easy, and we were definitely tight, but it was possible. And I can't say that could happen in every school, but I do believe in a majority of schools it's really possible. So, as I said, we could provide some assistance, put something together to help people should they, you know, walk through their schools and they just can't imagine. I think we have some very creative people, and again, it's about priorities and how you shift them around.
I'd like to talk just briefly, because one of the topics of conversation that came up throughout the committee was attendance. And currently we do provide funding, the state provides funding for half-day kindergarten programs. However, OARs does not require attendance until students are 7 years of age. So we have students in Oregon that are enrolling in public school kindergarten first grade classes, and there is no requisite that they attend. The truancy law doesn't take effect till age 7. So it kind of begs the question, is this a good steward of taxpayers' dollars? We're funding half-day kindergarten programs, hopefully full day soon, and first grade, and yet not requiring that students attend. And this has been an ongoing issue for schools. We really feel that all students who enroll in state-funded programs, kindergarten, first grade programs, should be required to attend upon enrollment. The parents made a commitment. They feel like public school education is important for their child, and yet the truancy laws do not take effect until the student is 7. The compulsory attendance age is at 7, and we don't have any qualms about keeping it at age 7. But, it still leaves parents a choice whether they want to enroll their student in school until they turn 7 or in first grade. Parents can enter their child in kindergarten currently at the age of 6 if they so desire. And while uncommon, parents may work with the school to request a half-day kindergarten program if they can provide compelling evidence that this is in the best interest of their child. And on a very rare occasion, that may happen. But what we find that most parents, once they enroll their student in public school grade level of kindergarten, there is a commitment for their child to attend school. However, we see that sometimes that becomes a little lax, and parents will say, well, I'm not really required to send them till the age of 7. And as we know, those academic behaviors such as attendance and school readiness start in kindergarten. And we have seen kindergartners with very poor attendance habits. That behavior continues, up through the school years. So we feel like it's in our best interest to change the law that requires parents to have their student attend school regularly upon enrollment. So we're asking for a change there.
If I could just add also, it's just not that child. It's the rest of the class that the teacher may have to go back and reteach that's slowing down the class. And once again, I think this is a great opportunity to create rigor throughout the system.
Mr. Chair, we talked about this issue for quite a while, and I think this is a very elegant solution and a very simple solution, that once they're enrolled, they're required to attend without getting into the debate about readiness. So I think this is a very elegant solution. I was real happy with it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. My example along attendance, not to belabor it, was I used to go out to students' houses who were not attending, and I talked to the parent, your third grader needs to be in school. The kindergarten was kept home as well for no real apparent reason. So I could tell the third grader they needed to be in school, but I couldn't tell the little brother or sister that they had to be in school, and it didn't make a lot of sense. The bottom line was, once they were in school, they should be in school. So that does give parents an out should they not want to enroll their kids up until 7. So I appreciate you saying that. I think most of you are probably familiar with Ozzie Rose. And
unfortunately,
see, look at
true.
All the smiles I got.
Ancient Mariner.
We did invite him to one of our meetings, and something that he talked to us about really struck a chord with the committee. And that was in the 80s, you may remember, we had a recession. And that was the time, actually, when half-day kindergarten came into being. They started from scratch. There was no kindergarten. And so there was the same kind of conversations that we're having, whether it was even a good idea. And then beyond that, if they did it, how would they fund it? So they, again, starting from scratch, put a bill out there in 81 and gave the schools until 1989, so 8 years, to get on board. Once they put the mandate out there, the schools did it well before the deadline. And I find that interesting because I think as educators, we're a pretty obedient group. So if you tell us to do something, we go do it. The great part for full-day kindergarten is, as Don mentioned, we already have at least half the state doing it. So it's about bringing the other half on. So there's some real parallels, even though we're at different starting places. As it has been mentioned, kindergartens have standards and learning targets. They're not there just for fun, although we sure like them to have fun. But they have some standards in front of them. And that's there because we want them to achieve and to better their educational chances. So we're asking, essentially, to give them the opportunity. Over the years, I've watched a lot of barriers put up, and I'm feeling pretty strongly that we need to start kicking them down. Because truly the time is right now. We can't wait any longer. So full-day kindergarten is the right thing to do. There's agreement around, and now it's, can we get going on it? So we wanted to put the presentation to you. The meat of our summary is on pages 3 and 4. That condenses it, but it's backed up with research and all the findings that we spent time looking at. We're extremely appreciative of having Senator Haas and Senator Cruz on the committee. That helped us in many areas in terms of drafting this. So we're hoping to really push forward on this and have your support. For today, we wanted to make sure we left enough time for questions. Usually that's a big part of all this. So we're more than happy to field any questions you might have on the issue.
Well, thank you all, Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your good work.
Thank you.
I'm curious, the 50% that do not offer full day, is there a unique socioeconomic profile for those schools that don't versus those that do?
That's a good question. Don may be able to answer that better, but...
Once again, in these economic times, I think it's possibly either a philosophy of the district, culture of the district. There could be some infrastructure issues. Personally, I think that probably every superintendent in the state of Oregon would like to have full-day kindergarten in their school districts. It improves the achievement. And I think that probably economics, that's what's causing them not to be there. However, I'll just go back once again. I made the comment, if I had the choice, I would cut senior year of high school and have full-day kindergarten if those were choices I had to make. That's how important I think it is. 90% of a child's brain is already developed by the time they enter public education. And that's where we're going to make the most significant impact is in those early years. So to answer your question, Senator Morris, I really believe it's probably economics, possibly infrastructure. I don't think it is an unwillingness on any school district to think that full-day kindergarten is not appropriate.
And if I may add to that, I do know that many of our districts have Title I dollars, federal dollars, and have had over the years a very compelling reason to offer full-day kindergarten to give those kids a head start. There is an inequity there because we have districts that don't have a lot of Title dollars because of the poverty rate is not as high. And so they are at a disadvantage because they cannot offer the program. And it may not be because they're not interested or willing or have a need. They just don't have the dollars to do that. So there is an inequity there currently.
For the record, committee, the committee did not vote on dropping the 12th year of...
I agree with your sentiment that it's more important than senior year, but we have plans for those seniors coming
right
up, so...
there.
Senator, Mr. Well, thank you for all your hard work, and I think just an observation and to reiterate some of the things that you said. I think one of the things, maybe a response to Senator Morris's question, just my own assumptions would be, is that, you know, why do some have it and don't? I think it's like a lot of things, and I think it's kind of between the lines of your presentation, and that is you need a driver. Someone needs to actually be passionate to make it happen. So when you say there's not opposition or whatever, they'd like to have it. But unless there's a Don or a Karen or someone else who's actually pushing it, then, you know, it doesn't going to happen because there are, like you say, I think Karen mentioned, the big picture thing, it's just overwhelming when you look at it, and unless you're able to break it down. The cost issue, I think as you folks move forward and trying to get this implemented, you know, it's always an issue with everything, but it's that big picture issue because you don't want to look at how do I make it work. And I think it's not just education, transportation, everything, you know, that we do. Don, with David Douglas joining my district, actually, I used to have a little piece of David Douglas. Tiger Tualatin, Beaverton, you know, everyone gets the same dollars per student. Somehow you make it work and they can't make it work. And that's not a criticism other than the fact that your drivers, you know, you have the passion about it. You walk around and say, okay, you know, how are we going to do this? And when you look at a funding issue for everything, you know, a lot of people, I think maybe it's just instinctive, they always look linear. And that is, okay, it's going to cost money.
And I have to layer this on everything else because they don't want to, they don't really want to look at everything else and say, what is the priority? And I think that's what the real message is here. I kind of think of kind of a comparison maybe to the Oregon Health Plan when that began in the 90s. You have all these procedures that are important for health, but at some point you don't have the dollars, and you have to actually do the hard thing and say, let's prioritize, you know, what are procedures in order that are going to be best for the healthy person. And I think with education, as you all struggle with dollars, you'll never have enough dollars to just keep layering things on for anything. But at some point you have to say, okay, if this is the priority, if this is actually going to be long-term a better investment in the child, you know, you mentioned the senior year, but if this is going to be the best investment in the child, then I think it's incumbent on all of us to have that hard look and say, okay, we're not going to just be able to layer on a lot of dollars to do everything. So let's take a look at, let's walk around our school, so to speak, in a way, intellectually as well as physically, and look at how do we do it different in order to meet those priorities. And I think if that's done, as you have done, I think on a state level, I think you will be able to advance this rather than saying, gee, it's just so overwhelming, I don't know where the dollars are going to come from. And I think you have and others have demonstrated not only can you make it work if it's the priority within your district, but also the results will provide long-term cost savers down the road for education.
Just to piggyback on what you're saying, one of the things that's happened, this conversation used to, I think, be mostly amongst elementary educators and parents because they wanted it so badly. And anymore, when I go into administrative meetings or broader district meetings, everybody's talking about it. So the high school principals are talking about it too, like, okay, I might be willing to kind of give a little here because I realize the importance of this, because now we have enough data and research to support that this is really important. It used to be, no, everybody kind of grabbed their turf and that was the end of the story. But the whole dialogue has completely changed within districts and across the state. Everybody's involved. And like I said, people who are involved with children who are within our law system, who've broken laws, and you know, I'm responsible now for a group of kids who are have sexually offended. I mean, we're talking about all kids now, and maybe the difference that full-day kindergarten would have made in these kids' lives, or of the ones who did have it, what's the difference? So it's from community college down and you know, the state colleges down to elementary schools. It's not just a small dialogue. It's a big dialogue.
And if I could add, just in Beaverton alone, being able to charge tuition under Senate Bill 44 currently, we went from having just full-day kindergarten in our title schools to 30 kindergarten classrooms, full-day kindergarten classrooms in Beaverton in 2 years. So the space is there. I think principals are starting to do those walk-arounds.
If I could just say something real quick. We have made efforts to prioritize full-day kindergarten, but also I really want you to note that those districts that have done that, there have been other things that have went away in our districts that we do feel important, and we are really asking for the full weight for full-day kindergarten. We think all of those other things that we're cutting out are important, too. They're just not as important as full-day kindergarten.
Thank you. It may be in your report. I just haven't had a chance to look at it yet. But if you look at the fiscal impact of going to a 1.0, what would be the biennial cost of that?
Go ahead, Don. we've estimated it at using approximately a $6,000 per student benchmark. By 2015-17 biennium, the cost would be approximately $140 million to add a complete full-day kindergarten for every child in every district in Oregon.
You know, if I might follow up, Mr. Chair, the comments of Senator Metzger at school-level prioritization comes back to where we are today, and looking at all available resources and making those appropriate priorities. you know, and you were looking at 2014, the expiration of Measure 66. Those are lottery dollars that would fund kindergarten. And what's more important, culverts or kids? I mean, you know, they're both important, but there are ways of achieving this.
You know, I agree with Mr. Grotting that, you know, the dropout rates, there's an effect here on full-day kindergarten. Dropouts are expensive. They're very expensive to society, and it would be impossible probably to quantify, but you do, I think it's valid to consider what would have happened if we would have implemented this in 2001. And we're 10 years forward, would we have the corrections costs that we have today? Would we have the DHS costs that we have today? And would there be savings because of full-day kindergarten 10 years ago? And like I say, it's very difficult math to do, but I know that there are educators who can point to research that says, yeah, there would be.
If I can add, one of the significant reductions we believe would be the reduction in special education requirements for districts as well as English language learner requirements, and being able to get those kids their language acquisition and the needed services for special education. And we believe that we could then reduce the number of second language students earlier in our system, as well as reduce the number of special education students.
To back that up, in my school alone, we exited more ELL students from having to learn English at an earlier age, and the kids that were exited earlier were all kids who had full-day kindergarten. So again, it was sort of a case in point. We can't say that full-day kindergarten, well, we could say, but I don't know if be 100% honest, that full-day kindergarten is going to take care of all the evils of the world. But we can say that it makes a huge difference, and we've had any kind of reform in recent years that has that kind of impact. We've done a lot of little things to help, but we really feel like this is a big thing that could make a difference over time. Now in alternative school settings, we have waiting lists that go on and on and on. And as the graduation requirements go up, the lists get longer because there's more kids who haven't had it at an early age. So again, we're asking the front end rather than, you know, their senior year, although there's certainly things we can do to help kids there.
To follow up on that, when you say you exit the ELL learners early, that means you're not getting the weighted compensation.
Yeah, it doesn't help us financially.
Yes.
But it, again, to the state, it, you know, saves money.
And I could see you doing that, the ELL. You said that also applies to special ed students. How does that work? When you exit, you can exit someone, and you think part of it is because those with access to full-day kindergarten.
Yeah, I think sometimes that students entering school at a later age, they do not have the background knowledge and need so much remedial work that if we get to them at an early age, maybe it will cause more children not to be identified. And also to be able to offer them those services earlier so that even if they are identified, they're going to be more successful in the system and not have as much of a drain on the resources as is being required right now. Also, I think something more important is it is an earlier chance for us to connect with the families of those children. And so they are involved with the education system at an earlier onset. And, you know, our schools right now are getting to be a one-stop. We feed, we transport, and a lot of times we provide social services. So getting those families connected with the services they need at an earlier stage of their child's life, I think, will help not only the child but the family.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow up on that. I mean, the science is there, not only for language, but, you know, if we have a lot of children with mild autism, the sooner we get to them, the quicker we can mainstream them. I mean, that's undeniable. the issue here isn't if, it's how. I mean, that's clear and defined, and that debate's over. And although some people keep wanting to bring it up, but that debate is over. My hope here is that as we move towards this, and clearly some schools can play musical chairs and make it work, but there are going to be some that have definite infrastructure needs, and my hope is that we will be informed of that as we move forward in time and see if we can do something to help with that issue. But one point that kept coming up, because we can't treat this in isolation, you know. This isn't the solution to everything. One of the points that kept coming up in the committee was, unless we ensure that we have an appropriate level of rigor in the rest of the system, going to full-day kindergarten accomplishes very little. And so I just want to, for the committee's information, that's something we need to pay particular attention to, is to make sure that if we give these kids this wonderful start at the beginning, that that we're making sure that they have what they need to get there. And you know, and from the national perspective, I was a few weeks ago at the meeting of the Education Commission of the States, and I should have known this but didn't. When you look at the gap that is widening between K-12 and higher ed as far as the need for remediation, that's something that we really need to pay attention to. When I was told that the reading level of textbooks in high school, 12th grade, are basically what they used to be at 8th grade, and freshman college textbooks are right where they've always been, we're creating a gap. And we're creating the need for a whole lot of remediation that shouldn't be there. So when we talk about making sure we have appropriate rigor in the system, these are the sorts of things we need to really be paying attention to. We have our new graduation requirements, but now we're throwing in core standards on top of that, and nobody is really quite sure what we're throwing in there. So this is very complicated. We just need to make sure as we move forward with this, we are not ignoring the rest of the system. Mm-hmm.
Brenda Lewis, Karen Twain, Don Gardin, thank you.
Thank you.
For all your work.
Thank you.
It was fun. Let's do it again, okay?
Thank you very much to all of you for listening and hopefully pushing us forward in the state. We're all clearly passionate about it. And I can count myself amongst many educators who have said, if it's the last thing we do before we retire, this is the one thing. This would make us happy in our golden years. So hopefully you can help us out. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. We're going to move on to the informational hearing to receive the report from the State Board of Education Online Learning. And we have Jerry Berger and Jan Combe going to come up for that. Hey, how are you doing? Welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Hash, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jan McComb, staff to the State Board of Education, and with me is board member Jerry Berger. Director Berger's been on the board, over 7 years now? And so I'm sure that he can answer any question you might have on any topic.
Thanks, Jan.
Set you up.
Exactly. Well, as you may recall, the board's been dealing with the topic of online learning for 3 years now. And with passage of House Bill 3660 earlier this year, the legislature gave the board some direction on what they would like. They asked that the state board do three things by September 1st, and that was develop a proposed governance model for virtual schools, review the appropriate levels and methods of funding for such schools, and also identify which virtual schools enrolled students with disabilities and how many students with disabilities attended those schools. The board discussed the online learning topic at every subsequent board meeting through August, and we even added an additional meeting in August to talk about it. It also formed a work group of stakeholders, and that work group met twice. And the final report was delivered to the legislature August 31st. Director Berger is going to talk about what's in the report, and then we'll answer any questions.
Thank you, Jan. Chair Haas, members of the committee, when asked to come and represent the board at this, the first thing I had to do was try to determine what I was going to tell you from the report, but keep in mind the board has been working on online education for over 5 years. We've had many hearings, we've had task forces, we've had work groups, so it's a topic that when I look at it, I have to get in my brain what happened 5 years ago, but where are we today? So I'm going to try to focus on where we are today. In your previous conversation, Senator Cruz mentioned the fact that we have to look at education as a whole, and online education is part of that whole. It's not the only answer, but it is an option. From 5 years ago, I believe the State Board of Ed is clearly convinced that online education has a place, meets students' needs, and is an important part of the overall education in Oregon. That was not a view 5 years ago. Now, there's still some people that don't quite believe that online education works, but there's no question it works for some students. And therefore, the State Board believes full-time online education is important for the students in Oregon. Keep in mind, the board has tried to have our discussions look at what is good for the student. Not necessarily what is good for the district, but what is good for the student. If it works for the student, it's going to work for districts, it's going to work for the state. The task you gave us was to come up with, and we gave you a report, you have a report, you have an executive summary, and I'll try to capture that executive summary. We believe that we must separate virtual online schools, that's statewide virtual online schools, from the charter school law. Charter schools deal with a set brick and mortar. They're in a set geographic area. Virtual is everywhere. So we believe we need a separate governance structure, separate laws regarding virtual online schools. And the big thing is that students are drawn from throughout the state, from all kinds of districts, so what one district thinks good for schools may not fit everybody, but we need an online virtual school clarification. We also believe that these online statewide schools should be under the auspices of a local school district and or educational service district as the method to do that. We don't believe that an online charter school should just kind of come out of nowhere or from somebody and start. We believe that they do need sponsorship from either a district or an ESD. Also, we believe that the state, to make sure that it's quality, we believe the State Board of Education, the Department of Education, needs to review these programs, these schools, because they're actually a school. And we think that because it affects perhaps all kinds of people and all throughout the state needs to review these schools. The other thing we have in the report is the fact that we believe that every school district should be encouraging online options. Many people believe that online education for most of the students might be a course or two, not necessarily every course. And you can see it in small districts around the state. We had a young lady that came from
Paisley.
Paisley's not very big. She's now a student at Willamette, and she took about 40% of her classes online at Paisley. It's a huge area where students can get training when that local school district can't afford the instructor, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we really believe that many, many students would take advantage of one or two courses online, which could easily be, and actually is happening in all of our schools statewide now. The other thing is, in looking at Oregon Connections Academy, which is the online school that's been the most and has, what, 2,500 students approximately, we've seen that there's a lot of transferring back and forth from online back to the local school district, roughly 33% of the students. Because of that, we believe the law should require parents to sit down and talk with the local school district regarding attendance in the online school. This is number one, to establish a relationship between the local school and the parent, and then in case the student does go and choose the online program, if it doesn't work for them, it's easier transition back. And that communication between the online provider statewide with the local school district, we believe, is very, very important. I'll get to specifics on enrollment in a minute, which supports that theory. Also, we believe that the present online school statewide should follow the new law within 2 years or whenever their charter is up. So they would be grandfathered in, and they would need to then go through the process to be approved as a statewide online school. In regards to enrollment, and this has probably been one of the most contentious questions, including within the State Board of Education. The question becomes, how much choice do parents have? That's a big question. Should they have any choice? Should they have a little choice? Should they have no choice? And we probably had input that goes that gamut. What we are initially recommending is that up to 3% of an individual district's students would automatically be eligible to attend a statewide school. The school district could not veto that choice. That would be a given, minimum of 3%. Presently, we have about 1% of our students are enrolled in online schools statewide. So we came up with a 3%. So if I'm a student at Salem Kaiser School District, I come in and talk to the school district regarding I want my child to attend this online school. If you haven't been impacted by 3%, the school district cannot veto that. So the parent does have that choice.
Is this on top of the 10 for the brick and mortar charter, or is this part of it?
No, this is, Chair Hess, I'm not quite, Senator Cruz, I'm not quite clear of that.
The question is this in addition to the percentage for the traditional brick and mortar charter, or is it a carve out of that?
This is stands by itself.
Okay.
It is by the virtual online statewide school. Yeah. We also have in that, in your report, we have the fact that it could rise to and then the district actually can choose. Let's say they hit the 3%, they could choose to release more students. And many districts in the state, in the present ongoing right now, and the waivers we've given on online, they have given opportunity for more than that to go. So the district could even. You know, the district could decide if it's above 3, they could release the student. We also believe that this is such a changing thing that we're saying that in what we've recommended to you is that the state board be given the option to raise that to 5% if it seemed to be justified, but we'd have to have hearings, et cetera, to do that. So that's kind of an enrollment thing. The reason the state board has put that 3% in there, we do have some examples where districts have basically, there's one online school statewide now that you must get released from the local district And some districts have had a blanket no-release policy, which the state board does not believe that makes sense for individual students. Now, there's not a lot, but there are some districts that have adopted that type of a policy, which they have the right to do. So if you're wondering why we have come up with that, that's the reason. Because the, and maybe they're doing it for all good educational reasons, but a blanket no doesn't appear to be to the state board a policy that makes sense for the state. And by the way, 3 to 5% is 16,000 to 27,000 of students if that was the case. You also ask us to look at funding. And this is probably the weakest part of the report because in the time frame of you giving us the charge and the funding, we have not been able to get done the studies of does online schools cost more, less, they're cheaper. There's all kinds of ramifications, transportation, all kinds of things. What we're recommending is that we would fund statewide online schools at 90% of the AMW, I'm a community college guy, the average daily membership, not FTE, ADM. And then 5% would stay with the district that's sponsoring it, or ESD, and 5% would go to the sending district for costs associated with that. That's a little different than the charter school rule, which is, I believe, Jan, 80% goes to the charter school and 20% goes to the local district. Right. And in high school, it's secondary schools, it's 95-5. Is that correct?
Yes, those are minimums.
So we've kind of said for online charter school would get 90%, and the remaining 10% would be divided equally among the district sponsoring and the district sending the student. We do need probably more study on the funding. That would be a consensus of the state board. We've looked at national studies, and you get a different, there is doesn't appear to be a consensus. The thing that I think the state board believes, it really depends on what the school is doing. It's so individualized, because you could take 90% and not do a heck of a lot, and it makes no sense, and then you might be doing more. That's why the state board believes strongly that the state's interest is to look at what that specific individual school would be doing with students in order to prove that they really are doing that. That's sort of a brief summary of what we've given to you. February 2009, you got our online learning report from the state board. You now have the online learning report of August 2010. You could go back, and there are other many, many discussions, et cetera, from the state board on online learning. I think the exciting thing is most people believe online learning is here. It can be effective. It is effective. Most people would also agree that some people aren't going to be learned through online techniques. They just, does not fit their learning style, does not fit their situation. So but we've come a long way in over 5 years of at least coming to the conclusion, yes, it does work, yes, it does meet student needs, and yes, it's an important part of the Oregon educational process. With that, I'd open up for questions.
Okay, Jan, did you have anything?
Senator Cruz wanted me to follow up on the charter school comment. I would just say that 10 years ago, when the law was first passed, they were schools of choice for a district. And so if you lived in a different area of town and you wanted to go to the charter school, the district couldn't tell you no. And if there was room, students from outside the district could also go.
Right.
And because people were nervous about a new idea, they capped it at 20%, that if that you couldn't have more than 20% of students from outside the district coming in. And after a few years of operation, they took that cap away because they just didn't feel like it was needed.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. The board's talking about a line of demarcation between brick-and-mortar charter and virtual charter. You talked about a line of demarcation between The area I'm most interested in, quite honestly, is the ability for an individual school district to import curricula and what we are going to do to make sure that the options a school district have meet the rigor necessary to meet standards. And quite honestly, to expect a school district or a teacher to look at the whole syllabus and make that determination would be daunting, and we need some sort of clearinghouse. And I agree with you that online is going to be a big part of the future, but I'm looking at a lot of my small rural schools and their ability to offer Japanese or Chinese as an option. They aren't going to be able to do it unless we have this in the toolkit. So are you looking at that as a separate issue from the charter discussion is going to go on and on, but the ability for us to have a clearinghouse so that districts can import what they need, I think is also very critical. Where is the board on that discussion?
Chair Haas, Senator Cruz, members of the committee. Right now, districts are bringing in, I would say, hundreds of courses to their schools. One out of seven students get credit for college credit in their schools. Now, that some of that's taught by their student, but we're doing that right now.
Right.
We believe that there is the virtual school district that you help sponsor that creates courses at the state of Oregon, which those courses are reviewed, et cetera, et cetera. Then you have that whole group of courses coming from Chemeketa Community College, University of Oregon, Harvard, whatever, that people are accessing. Approving every course, to me, is all but impossible. I mean, it'd bring you to your knees from a standpoint as either a local school district or a state, because there's just so many options. But what the board has done, and you're going to hear more of this in 2012. Get ready. Senator Cruz mentioned graduation requirements. In 2012, and in the past, graduation requirements have consisted of courses, certain array of courses, there's more. It used to be 21 credits. Since I've been on the board, it's now 24 credits. And a student has to get D or better, and they get those courses, they can graduate. State Board of Education has adopted a new graduation requirements that in the year 2012, there must be a minimum reading competency for a student to graduate from high school, even if they've completed all of those 24 units. So we put in some check and balance of, does the student really know something? I can see bristling in the back of the room, because most students, when they get a high school diploma, do know things. They've had a rigorous curriculum, et cetera, et cetera. Some students, however, and you talked about remediation. Community college, you can look at community colleges. I'm familiar with them. 19 to 20% of their offerings are remedial. Now, a lot of that are adults. A lot of that's not 18-year-olds. So don't pick on the K-12 system for all that remediation. A lot of that are working adults or non-working adults, et cetera. So in 2012, there's a reading competency. It can be done by testing. It can also be done by samples within a school district that school district guarantees that student has that reading competency. 2013, now the furor is going to come. That's the juniors of this year when 25% of our students, I'm guessing, don't meet that minimum competency. You're going to be inundated, those of you still lucky enough to be in the legislature,
or unlucky enough,
whichever way, with parents and educators. We can't not pass my kid, et cetera, et cetera. So get ready. 2013, it's going to be writing. 2014 is going to be mathematics. So in some regards, the state board's opinion, this is really getting tough when I say state board opinion. But I think the general consensus is we've adopted the minimum competencies, the essential skills, to guarantee that if you have an online course coming in and you're doing mathematics, it's going to be tested eventually by does the student meet the requirement for mathematics for graduation, which means if that's the case, you don't have to do every individual course. You have a portfolio that student has finished courses, 24 units, and then meets essential skills that are demanded by the high school diploma. Now, I don't know if that answers your question, but this is the first time the state board, and a lot of you have been here a long time, with SIM and CAM. SIM and CAM was never mandatory. It was always optional. It was never required for graduation except maybe in one or two districts. The SIM was. CAM was never, I don't believe, was demanded. So this is the first time in 2012, 2013, 2014, there are some essential skills that a high school graduate must have in order to get an Oregon high school diploma. That's a really big check and balance on if students are learning from all-day kindergarten, third grade, benchmarks all the way through.
Okay. Senator Morse?
Thank you. In the private world, rework sinks businesses. I mean, you can only go so far at rework, and then pretty soon things come apart. Raising the standards is measuring at the end. My concern, and I support that, but my concern is how do we know that the process that's ongoing is meeting the standards to eventually get to the end? And my question specifically is, has accreditation kept pace with the evolution of technology and the hybrids models of learning that exist? And who does that? How is it done? So that we have some assurance that we are, in fact, meeting the standards in the process. So you pretty well assure the outcome at the end when graduation comes around.
Chair Haas, Senator Morse, members of the committee, Jan McComb could comment on accreditation, and I'm familiar with accreditation for community colleges. And that's been addressed clearly in community colleges, but it's really up to the college to say this course is okay, et cetera. And I believe in accreditation for the K-12, that
would be
similar.
I believe it's a regional organization that accredits high school credits. And each year, school districts sign a form saying that they meet Division 22 standards, and those are the standards that are required by the Department of Education to be a standard school. And so we don't have the money to go out and inspect every school to see if they're meeting standards. We are doing field visits now, is my understanding, kind of on a random basis. They are all required to follow the standards that are written in administrative rule and law. And I know that with online learning, we have experts in the department who really focus more on teaching, how to teach effectively online, and they're coming up with standards and how to do that effectively. I don't know if the national or that regional organization has standards for online learning specifically in technology, but I can look into that for you.
Mr. Chair, I don't want you to go to a lot of work, but my concern is that as these things evolve, how do we have assurance that the product, the process, is what we want it to be to assure that these rigorous standards at the end will be met? So that's my question, is how are we addressing that?
I think the decision was made that the state sets the ending point, what we want to see at the end, and we don't tell schools how to get there. And that's a local school board decision. And so some districts are wonderful and very innovative and at the edge of the curve, and other districts, for whatever reason, aren't. And we go in with our staff and try to help them. We look at test scores and see who's failing to really meet
our expectations and try to help them. I think the department is looking at interventions for those districts that are failing to show the kind of progress we want to see in order for these children to be ready for their next steps after high school.
Chair Haas, Senator Morris, members of the committee. The state of Oregon has data on schools that clearly shows, as a group, how they are scoring. There are benchmark tests that show, and it's, I know it's a test, and you can argue, does it really, you know, there's tons of arguments, pros and cons on that. But the state of Oregon has identified schools regarding their performance. It's there. You can track that performance, actually, back to the specific teacher. You can, and then the question, so there is data there. I noticed that you had the ex-superintendent of NISA up earlier, Don. And NISA is probably one that has been pointed out. They've had huge success regarding serving people that, if you look at data, demographics, they shouldn't be as successful as they are. They've obviously looked at their data, struggled with it, and have, within their money they get from us, have had huge success using it, etc. The question mark districts all struggle with is, are the schools that build on your first grader, second grader, third grader, fourth grader, fifth grader, and I'm biased. If a kid doesn't know how to read, but you know, doesn't have basic reading skills at the third grade, you can show that they aren't going to be successful in a community college or senior or whatever, so you have to focus on those skills. And we have data, school districts have data. The question mark is when and how do they intervene? What techniques do they use? And what's their, how do they deal with their parents, et cetera, to make sure that those students are learning? But there's data that you could go and look at every school district in the state and see how they're performing, see what they're doing. And actually, the State Superintendent of Public Instruction has highlighted schools that are working for the since I've been on the board, and you can see schools that, you know, and that doesn't mean the other schools aren't working, but it's highlighting people that have had great success with all of their students. There's data there, and the question mark is do we have the nerve to look at the data and try to ascertain nerve that's I'm getting out of line now. This isn't the board speaking. This is Berger speaking. It takes a lot of courage to tell a parent that, you know, your third grader hasn't really learned. Therefore, what are we going to do together to make sure you do learn, and what steps do I have to take, even maybe not putting you in the fourth grade or whatever? And oftentimes that takes courage. But I'm getting wound up now. This isn't state board speaking. This is Berger speaking.
It's
so.
Okay.
There's really good data regarding how our children are doing. And we need to analyze that data, not worrying how my district looks like or my school looks like or my classroom looks like, and make decisions to help students learn. And many, many districts are doing that very, very well.
Thank you. And we appreciate you getting wound up, and you did hear bristling in the back of the room, but that's okay. In this committee, there's always a lot of bristling in the back of the room. So, thank you for your work on this. Look forward to working on implementing some of the legislation from this. And
thank you.
Thank you. We're going to move to an informational hearing on vision. Superintendent's Vision Policy, the Oregon Association of School Executives, Mary Alice Russell and her crew. Welcome to the Capitol. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us. I'm Mary Alice Russell, and I am the current president of the Oregon Association of School Executives. I'm going to ask a couple of my colleagues to introduce themselves who are up with me at the table today.
Good morning. I'm Krista Perrin, superintendent, South Plains School District in Cottage Grove, and I'm also the president of COSA this year.
And I'm Ron Wilkinson, Superintendent Van Lepine Schools, and I'm the President-elect of OASC, the State Superintendent's Group.
Chair Haas and Chairman Morris and the rest of the committee members, I would also like to just take a moment to introduce some of my other colleagues who are here with me today. We have a number of superintendents in the audience who are part of this process, and of course they're representing many others who are not here today, and I wonder if those supes would stand and at least say your name and district, please.
My name is Rob Ness, Superintendent Levin, Oregon.
Paul Redditch, Superintendent Neuter.
Rob Saxon, Superintendent Tiger for all the schools.
Sandy Huss, Salem Kaiser.
Nancy Golden, Springfield.
Mark Mulvihill, Umatilla-Maury, ESD.
Cole Gill, Bethel School District.
Thank you all for coming. Welcome to the Capitol.
Well, as I indicated, I'm Mary Alice, and I'm a superintendent of McMinnville School District. I'm from Yamhill County. We're a district of 6,500 students, obviously serving grade K through 12, and I'm proud of our many accomplishments in McMinnville schools. Last year, for example, we awarded 4,000 college credits to students enrolled in dual high school programs, dual high school college credit programs with partnership with Chemeketa and a variety of other community colleges. That saved parents over $150,000 in tuition that otherwise would have been paid for their students leaving our campus and not beginning their college career until after high school. Most recently, we had exciting news in McMinnville. We were recognized for having the National Middle School Principal of the Year within our district, and we've been doing a lot of celebrating these last couple of weeks in recognition of that individual and the accomplishments in their school. We'll have three schools that will be rated outstanding on their upcoming Oregon report card, and we over time have made significant gains with the percentage of our students meeting Oregon benchmarks in reading and math. This last year, several grade levels exceeded 90% of students that were either achieving their benchmark or exceeding it. And in fact, we had one third grade classroom, I believe, where all the students 100% passed, and that included students who were in the class on IEPs. But I'm not really here representing McMinnville School Districts as much as I am representing the Oregon Association of School Executives, which represents Oregon superintendents and the thousands of students and wide array of student successes in their districts. I'm here because superintendents across the state believe that with our staff and our community, we will continue to demonstrate local successes like the ones I've described for my own district. Collectively, we think, though, we can do even better for our students. We believe that Oregon students should be globally competitive and that this is the time for bold leadership to nurture Oregon's most valuable resource, our children. We imagine an Oregon whose students perform as well or better than any student in the country on any national exam. An Oregon whose students score as well as children in other countries in math and science. And an Oregon that attracts, develops, and keeps the best teachers in our nation to deliver outstanding learning opportunities for our kids. In fact, we envision an Oregon where students graduate from high school with the skill and knowledge they need to successfully pursue their dreams in this rapidly changing world. We believe Oregon students must be equipped to compete in the global economy and to contribute to our society. And we know their future depends on it. Can you imagine an Oregon where all citizens are equipped to pursue their dreams? We think this is possible with superintendents sharing a common vision that is aligned with the governor, legislators, state superintendent of instruction. And we think it is time for bold leadership and have begun the process of coming together, both as a group of superintendents and today to share with you our work to date. We're asking for your support and willingness to review future proposals from our group as we move forward. Could you imagine an Oregon where all of us were aligned with a common vision for the education of our children? This past spring, several superintendents came together to shape a vision. Partnerships were formed with Stand for Children, and they were represented by Sue Levin, who I think is here with us today. Sue, could you stand? We also had help through Chalkboard, and Sue Hildick is here. And I think, Sue, could you identify yourself in the back, as well as Dan Jameson? We had formed partnerships with the Oregon Business Association, Julie Brim Edwards, and also here today representing them, I believe, is Morgan Allen. I'm not sure where Morgan is.
Anderson.
Hello. You saw some of the superintendents in the room today who were part of this group, and as I said, several more who are not here with us today. Later, OASE, the organization I represent, actually established this official task force vision policy as a task force to continue this work. The documents before you have been discussed and supported by the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, you might otherwise know as COSA, their funding coalition, which is made up of more than 40 superintendent members. And most recently, all of these items were discussed and supported by the collective group of Willamette Education Service District superintendents, its executive council, which represents 21 superintendents. We'll continue to discuss this vision among the superintendents, including our next meeting in October. The vision overview, which you should have in front of you, looks like this. It's captured on a single-page handout. And you'll see that it has a bold statement that I've spoken to already, as well as three pillars of success. The additional colored materials, which should be a separate stapled document, or it may be stapled to your cover sheet, but it looks like this, blocks of green and blue and yellow. The colored materials represent the action categories or areas that we believe we can act on quickly, and those areas that may take a little longer to achieve as we begin transformation process from vision to reality. So green, for example, signifies actions that we think could happen in the short term. Blue, those areas that may take just a little longer, and yellow, those things that may be longer term due to other barriers that we may not have fully determined yet. But I want to walk you through the color sheet, if I could, and draw your attention to the actions that we think are necessary to achieve the vision that I've described to you. The first blocks are in green, and the category is improved statewide governance. We believe that it is important to make the state superintendent of public instruction an appointed position on the governor's cabinet. We hope to pursue this agenda item moving forward and hopefully in this legislative session. We believe it's important to create a P20, a preschool through graduate school council, in lieu of the state boards of education and higher education, or as oversight for those two entities. In this time of economic hardship, when it's important to look for efficiencies, we think that's one avenue that not only can accomplish some efficiencies, but in addition to that, can better articulate the work we do at the school and district level. The next one, and the next block, which happens to be blue in color, is the category of increased accountability and assessment systems. We think it's important that we continue to do research on best practices in state accountability systems that are transparent and lead to informed decision making. That work is already in process, and we want to advocate not only its continuation, but completion. The next category, which is on, I believe, your third page, and is a mixture of green and yellow in those subtext areas, is maximize teacher quality through exemplary educator strategies. We think it's important to implement a rigorous statewide performance evaluation system for every educator with concrete measures of student achievement as a significant factor. The evaluation must be proficiency-based and aligned with adopted standards. But we think it is important to strengthen the statewide delivery system of quality core professional development that is research-based, ongoing, sustained, and centered on student achievement. And while there have been efforts to do that through the Department of Education and their local regional ESDs, every school district is different in terms of the resources they have available to them, and it has been implemented across the state in a varied fashion. We think all teachers deserve that level of professional support. Continue and expand Oregon's commitment to sustain mentorship for new teachers and administrators, and explore and develop new career pathways and new compensation models by investing in research-based initiatives like the CLASS Project. This is not a new concept. We've been talking about this in Oregon for some time, and many states have adopted those practices already, and we do believe it's time to move forward. Adopt a rigorous, internationally competitive curriculum, and I believe that is on your next page. And the categories within that include, or the actions within that include, adopting and beginning a process of alignment to national common core standards. We have worked very hard in terms of the standards we work on in the state of Oregon, but we really think it's imperative to begin looking at how are Oregon students performing relative to other students in the nation. Develop formative assessments in math and language arts to align with standards. And predominantly districts work on these formative assessments on their own, but how helpful it could be if, as a statewide, we have a variety of those assessments for school teachers to draw upon. provide professional development and implementation support to school districts for all of these actions. The next item is close the achievement gap. Establish high-quality professional development to meet the needs of students at risk. So give teachers the additional training they may need if they happen to have a population that is more needy than others. We do that now. In some forms, you may think about schools who are failing relative to the AYP language and coaches are assigned to those buildings. Wouldn't it be nice if we were proactive and the training for teachers happened at the front end and those schools never had to fail, meaning those students never had to fail in the first place? Accelerate learning for students at risk. Require early identification of academic performance concerns using formative assessments. Train schools and teachers to use the data from formative assessments to design, select, and implement appropriate instruction. You know, the bulk of our assessment in students is summative. We do these one-year tests, and we say children are doing well or children aren't. What we really need to be doing is having dipstick tests along the way so that we're seeing how students are doing with a particular concept each week, each month, and teachers have the opportunity to modify their instruction at that point in time, moving forward, causing all students to be successful by year end. Design and implement a system to identify academic needs for 3- and 4-year-olds. Implement quality pre-K programs within the K-12 system. Fund and implement full-day kindergarten. You know, my district is 54% poverty. Many districts have more poverty than that. And what I know is students come to school behind by the time they're in grade K. In fact, we all know that. I think it's time for Oregon to step up and to address those students and their learning needs in grades 3 and 4. And we would be bragging about many more successes if students weren't starting kindergarten from behind the starting line. Employ equity-based funding solutions so that research-based K-12 intervention programs, including smaller class size, extended time, specialized curriculum, etc., can be mandated at schools serving populations at risk of failing to meet Oregon's new diploma requirement. Fund and require high schools to implement intervention programs for students not on target to meet essential skill requirements for the Oregon diploma. In our own high school, we have struggled with our students achieving benchmark levels at the secondary level, not unlike many districts in the state. This past year, we implemented an intervention program, and we ended up with the 14th highest number percent of students meeting benchmark. That's a huge gain for us in our district when we were falling below the 50% line prior to that. We know these things work. It's time to move forward boldly and to make sure we implement them for our children. Other emerging ideas we're talking about, just as you are, includes the topic of ESDs. We know it will be a topic this session moving forward. We do think it's important to consolidate services and guarantee efficiencies. And in fact, superintendents are discussing this very topic now. We just had a meeting a couple weeks ago. We'll be following it up in the weeks ahead and be sharing with you our recommendations to impact ESDs, helping them be more efficient and helping them be more successful with the regional school systems. The Oregon Transfer Module and dual enrollment, you heard me talk about our successes in McMinnville in terms of students earning college credit. It's all about that articulation between K-12 and post-secondary. We know in this day and age more than ever, students will need to have a post-secondary education of some sort of quality in order that they are going to have family living wages and be competitive in this economy. I think also they're going to be the reason we pull out of this economy as we continue to make our students and adults more competent moving forward as a result of their education. So here with me today are several school district superintendents. They represent school districts varied in size and demographics. We are all here to express our support for the agenda and believe this is the important work we must do regardless of the economy. And as I said earlier, if there is one thing we believe can help Oregon's economy best, it is a well-educated and globally competitive society. Can you imagine this for Oregon? We can. We think the actions outlined will help us get there, and we hope you will help us get there, too. I want to thank you for extending us these few minutes of your time. We would like to stay here if you have any questions and address those for you if you like.
Thank you. You have an ambitious checklist here. We have some of the very same items on our checklist, too. Questions?
Okay.
Senator Cruz?
I like the concept of a state board of education. I think it's long overdue. In fact, I have legislation in to address that. And where I have probably a separation with y'all is I'm not in favor of the superintendent being a gubernatorial appointment. I want the superintendent to be an employee of the board. And this isn't saying anything negative about any governor, but gubernatorial appointments tend to be more political than I think is warranted. So, of course, my vision would require a minor little thing like a constitutional amendment. But and my board encompasses everything, and that board hires a superintendent to make sure we get somebody totally qualified to manage an enterprise of that size. And so that's my legislative concept that will be coming forward. So I encourage you all to take a look at it and maybe think you're a little outside the box. Maybe we need to go a little more outside the box.
And if I may comment, one of the things that we would share with you is that we do think there needs to be a criteria and set of qualifications for this individual. And we would talk about superintendents as a particular interest group. We want to further certain things for students that we believe is important. But we think, rather than being an elected position, if it's an appointed position, whether it be by the governor or by a different entity, it does become a person who's an employee of that board and is not necessarily subject to a variety of interest groups. And while that's okay, I mean, I certainly would want my voice to be heard by state superintendent of instruction, whether they were elected or appointed. What we think is critical is that we recognize this is very challenging work, and the individual sometimes has to make tough decisions that are in the best interest of kids. And ultimately, that's the largest concept we're after. But to get around the whether it would be too much of a political appointment, we would like to share information that we think would be important about the criteria that is attached to it, whether appointed by governor or other. We do think the governor's appointment gives it a level of status that is very critical throughout the state in terms of recognizing this individual for their leadership and their ability to move agendas forward. But thank you for sharing your ideas as well.
Short follow-up. I've wrestled with a lot of these, like the criteria, and where I came down on that was this new board would develop the criteria. I didn't think that should be something that a political body did. It should be done by the experts in the field. So that's clearly part of it. I think there's merits both ways, and I think that'll be a robust discussion as we move forward.
Senator Morse.
Thank you. And thank you for this vision. It stretches a lot, and thank you. My question is, with respect to the Unified Council, as you know, the university system is making recommendations, fairly significant recommendations, with respect to governance issues and funding. Have you processed this concept with them? Or is it lying out here by itself?
We have a list of next steps, and included on our next step are to talk to those other entities. And we have not collectively as a group done so yet, but that is one of our next several steps to take. We think it's really important. The success of Oregon lies in the success of all of our educational systems. And that's why it's critical that we are combined in terms of a P20 system. We believe this cannot do anything but further the agenda of higher ed as well as K-12 in terms of the relevance for student learning in our state.
Well, thank you for these comments and for your checklist. Like I said, it is an ambitious checklist, and we will be leaning on you for more help as the session unfolds, and that also means leaning on you to convey to your own representatives in Union, Mendville, and elsewhere to help us pass that. That's how you can help us most pass some of these things here.
I would add for your interest that the superintendents of the three largest districts in the state are on board with this. So Carol Smith, who couldn't be here today, Portland, Jerry Colonna, Beaverton, you saw Sandy Husk, Salem in the audience, and they have all been part of this process, as well as a number of superintendents who are from small school districts, and so we're excited about that. And to Ron or to Krista, any comments you would want to add?
Well, I think our commitment to you is to also work with our own representatives and senators in the process. We understand it's more than just you.
Well, I called Jerry Colonna this morning at 6:30, and he had been up for a long time.
Well, sure. Mm-hmm.
And we talked about some of these things, and so good to know. Thanks.
Thank you for your time.
We are miraculously on time, and we have a couple more presentations to go. I would propose a 5-minute stretch break. and if we could report back here at 9:35. fictional session of the Senate Interim Committee on Education. And we have chalkboard lined up here to do a school district collaboration fund presentation. And I think Sue Hildick and Dan Jameson are on deck.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sue Hildick, the president of the Chalkboard Project. I'm happy to be here. And I'm happy to bring with me the newest member of the Chalkboard team, Dan Jameson, who is an educator who's been 32 years in the business. We lured him from the Sherwood School District, but actually he was looking for his next step, and so we're happy to have him at Chalkboard as sort of the superintendent that has helped build the class project and is furthest along. And you will hopefully be seeing a lot of him and using him as a resource in your deliberations. We're excited to be here. You've heard about class many times, but we have three key messages today. First of all, we have results now, second-year results out of our first three districts, and we have information for you on that. Frankly, we're blown away. Sherwood and Tillamook are doubling the student growth results of their comparator districts across the state. Tillamook, 3.5 times the gain of their comparator districts. There are a lot of reasons for that, and I'm going to let Dan walk you through that, but suffice it to say, the early indicators are really strong for the project. Secondly, we just found out about 20 minutes ago that we did land the federal grant of $11.3 million to help the 9 new class districts implement their programs. So that's Ben Lapine, Albany, Redmond, Lebanon, Oregon City, Crook County, and Salem-Keizer. So we're thrilled about that. And then thirdly, we're here because you remember we had a bill in the last session that would create a statewide grant program around this model. We're going to come back with that in the upcoming session. We hope it will be a committee bill. We want to talk to you about that today. We have some ideas about the shape that that could take. And we have really appreciated the opportunity to have a conversation with you about it. So that said, I'm going to turn it over to Dan to walk you through that proposal.
Great. Thank you. Good morning, Chairman Hess and Senators, old friends and new friends as well. It's good to be here before this committee again. The School District Collaborative Grant Program, currently LC 1289, is a locally driven, research-based reform initiative. We believe that it holds great, great promise. The bill is a refinement of Senate Bill 1048 from the 2010 supplemental session. The language with this version is abbreviated, it's more general, and allows for details to be determined at the local level. This bill would require the State Board of Education to establish a school district collaboration fund, which would provide grants for school districts that voluntarily, and I stress voluntarily, choose to participate in reform efforts. You will notice that there are some key criteria that we believe are familiar to you because they are cornerstones of the class effort that has generated such success. Those key cornerstones are career paths, evaluation processes that are more rigorous, and teacher design compensation systems. This work is essential to the success of our schools. As Sue has just shared with you, the amazing results we've seen over the course of the first 2 years of implementation, we simply believe that those districts that are ready to take on this work should have that opportunity. We would also ask for a great deal of accountability around these funds. The Department of Education would be required to accumulate, evaluate, and publish student achievement data for those districts that voluntarily access these grants. We're proposing a funding source as a placeholder. And quite frankly, we want to use this to generate a starting conversation. This recommendation that we are making would be from the current ESD funding formula. I would like to share with you personally, as a superintendent, I have had interaction with 4 different ESDs. There are some ESDs that are amazingly efficient and customer-oriented. There are others that, quite frankly, are not. As a superintendent, I will share with you there were years when up to 20% of our ESD allocation was unspent. We simply believe that we are in a time where we need greater efficiency and we need to prioritize our decisions, and especially those decisions that are generating great results. As you know, ESD has currently received 4.75% of the SSF allocation. Our proposal calls for 0.75% of this amount, or roughly 16% of the current ESD allocation to be targeted to the school district collaborative grant program. This would raise about $45 million per biennium. Again, we want to share that we offer this to start the conversation. Chalkboard is open to other funding sources within the existing school funding mechanism. Additionally, if a school district wanted to engage in other reform efforts, the district would apply for a waiver to use the grant funds differently. We know, and what we've learned over the course of the last 10 years, and certainly a growing movement nationally, is that teacher and leader quality makes the difference for our kids, more so than any other factor. We believe that our funding priorities need to reflect this. We have demonstrated success. We would not force this model on anyone, yet at the same time, we would respectfully suggest to this committee that districts that are ready ought to have that choice. Currently, demand exceed supply. We have many, many more districts that want to jump on board, and we would like the opportunity to deliver what is meaningful for our kids. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions on this?
Do we have LC, Mr. Chair, 1289 in our material? I didn't see it.
We don't have it here. It's a work in progress. And
could be done in December.
Yeah, no, it will be done by December.
I
want to acknowledge, too, by the way, letters in support that you all have from Stand for Children on this concept and from the Oregon Business Association. Senator Cruz?
It's just interesting how there's so many groups that are involved in education, and yet it seems like there are a lot of parallel tracks happening here. So there is a fair amount of commonality in directions we're going. I find that very encouraging.
Not necessarily in opposition to each other's different tracks, but like you say, moving forward.
Moving forward, and I think we're going to have incredible opportunity. You know, clearly we're in some tight financial conditions in the state of Oregon, but sometimes that sort of situation creates opportunity out of necessity and forces us to do some things that may take us out of our comfort zone. And I do agree, every study I've seen shows that the best school districts have great superintendents, the best schools have great principals, and you know, that's kind of where it all starts. And the data is incredibly convincing that if we have the right people in the right places, the opportunity for kids to succeed is greatly enhanced. So,
Sue, could you fill us in on the grant?
Sure. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the grant is from the federal TIF program, which is called the Teacher Incentive Fund, which actually has been around for a while. It was a Bush program that President Obama lifted up and put a fair amount of stimulus money into, over $400 million. And what it does is it tests new career models. It has a pretty heavy emphasis on performance pay for teachers. So it's stronger in that piece than classes. Class is much more of a comprehensive career support model. But we had 7 districts who found support amongst all their partners, including the union, their school boards, their administrators, to apply with us for TIF. And those are all districts that have been in class, plus Albany, which is a new district coming into the program. And this will be a 5-year funding path for those districts to implement their class designs. There'll be a little bit of a ramp up on what the feds require in that we'll be exploring the linkage between student achievement and teacher performance, and we'll be testing different ways to do that. Nobody really knows how to do that well, frankly, so it'll be a learning process. We are so excited because we think it's a chance for the feds to really understand why class is working. We've spent a lot of time with the folks at the U.S. DOE explaining that we think it's a comprehensive model, that the career ladder piece and the professional development is just as important as the evaluation and the compensation. And I think we're making some progress there. So it's a good opportunity to continue to do that.
Who will administer the grant?
It'll come to Chalkboard. We will be the fiscal agent and the administrator, and we have now a growing cadre of class coaches that Dan is overseeing that will fan out and help these districts move their designs forward.
So you'll go from 12 to 19?
No, this will fund existing districts in the program. We will have a total of 13 districts, seven of whom will receive federal funding under this grant. Not everybody was eligible because it is targeted at high-need schools, which are 50% free and reduced lunch. So some of our districts, Sisters and actually Vernonia, interestingly enough, don't fit that criteria. So they won't be receiving federal dollars, but they will probably continue to receive Chalkboard dollars.
Questions?
I would suggest, RACE had some similar provisions as far as performance-based, and I would suggest that we make an attempt to redefine that. If we're doing it on an individual teacher basis, I think it's doomed to fail in so many ways. But if we do performance based as a school, as an educational facility, that's something that can actually work. And to a degree, it's asking the feds to rethink and redefine, but I think this is an opportunity maybe to move in that direction.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, we completely agree. And class tests both of those things, mm-hmm. team-based awards, individual awards, and we're testing a lot of things. And I think we have a real opportunity here to help the feds understand what can work.
Well, thank you.
Frank.
Senator Morse.
Thank you. Could you speak to the results?
Yes.
Today?
Actually, I'm going to ask Dan to do that.
Okay. Speak to the results of class after 2 years?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir. What we're finding is that the amount of growth is unprecedented, and I say that from my experience as a superintendent. We have seen in year one, which we expected we would see an implementation dip and not an increase, I believe that we increased achievement in 16 out of 20 measures, which we reported on. We were cautiously optimistic that trending would continue. Not only did that trending continue, but the amount of achievement and growth was more substantial than we had ever seen before. We especially would highlight the results at the secondary level and grades 6 through 10, where I know we are all very passionate about improving our delivery and what we're seeing in terms of outcomes for students. There's another piece of information that you have with you in that results package, and I think this is the piece that we feel so passionately about. And Senator Cruz, I believe it gets to the issue that you just raised, and that is, what is the level of enthusiasm, buy-in, and voice in decision-making that our teachers at the table can exercise? There is a graph there that you see. It's a research-based instrument that's designed by Shirley Hoard. It's widely respected in the professional education community. And what you see is an absolute transformation in attitude with rates of approval that began 3 years ago at 10, 15, 20% that now show 70, 80, 85% of our teachers are buying into this work and saying it's making a difference in their careers and certainly for our children.
Tillamook is just stunning. They met AYP for the first time. And I think if Randy Shield were here, who's the superintendent of Tillamook, he would tell you it's because they are now allowing time for their teachers to work collaboratively, looking at data, adjusting their practice. There are some incentives on the table for performance as well. And it's been really exciting to watch that. We need to, Mr. Chair, thank all of you for the support letters you provided for the federal grant. We're very grateful for that, and it showed, I think, a strong commitment from the state to be a part of this conversation. Thank you.
A follow-up, Senator Morse. With respect to maybe a funding issue and how this begins to propagate on a wider scale as public policy, rather than just kind of focusing as we are now, what is the professional development component of our K-12 appropriation? It's been a while. I've not looked at it, but mm-hmm. in the past it's been fairly significant.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, let me speak from memory, Senator Morse, but we have a paper on it that's about 2 years old, and I think, it, if I recall correctly, we were spending about $130 million on PD across the school districts with very little understanding of where those dollars were going and what the accountabilities were. And you may remember that Chalkboard partnered with OEA to survey teachers about how they felt about professional development, and we found a lot of gaps. People were not feeling like it was particularly useful. I remember a term that came out of that work was drive-by professional development. People were sort of dipping into different topics for a few hours and not really getting tools on a continual basis to change their practice. So CLASS moves to a model of job-embedded for professional development on a regular basis in teams, again, that collaborative learning mode, which teachers seem to be very hungry for. It's actually a pretty isolating profession. So to bring folks together and do that professional development in a group seems to be having a lot of traction.
Thank you. We've got about only 180 districts to go now.
Yes.
That's on our way.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, an education policy framework proposal up next. Lori Wimmer, Tricia Smith, Craig Hawkins, Tricia Yates in the crew.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing the Oregon Education Association. I brought with me three colleagues who will share the stage here to talk to you a little bit about a mechanism that we use that is a measuring instrument for assessing new policy concepts that come to us. It's how we have informally operated for probably decades. Some of us are older than dirt and been around for a long time. And we have formalized the way it looks so that we can share it with others who may or may not have a sense of how to go about assessing policy, not only for what it says, but how it aligns with our state objectives, our state laws, our policies and vision regarding education, and the funding that goes with a lot of those new initiatives, so that we can assess whether or not it's an idea that is in alignment with those, with our Oregon's educational vision, or not in alignment. And if it is in alignment, is it the next best use of the first new dollar, or is there something else that is on a timeline basis, a first or higher priority? So we have turned to some of the key pieces of our Oregon laws to use as a guidance, as well as to the funding. And so I thought I'd walk you through how we operate and what our assumptions are, and just show you very quickly what that looks like. We were invited to do that for you. Okay. I'm going to get my computer to work here. Here we go. What we have tried to do when we look at public policy is to build on all the past consensus that's been derived in this building, at the State Board of Education, and so on, with respect to the creation of statutes and administrative rules, and build on that past consensus, because a lot of hard work is done, and it would be a shame to depart from all of that heavy lifting of your predecessors and colleagues. We also always have an eye toward what is it that is found in the best practices to optimize student learning and with our educational goals, and that we see the needs of all students in balance and not discreetly focus on just a few at the expense of the many, that we look at public policy in terms of how all schools and all students benefit on balance, particularly considering resources and their scarcity. And so to do that, we look at the key elements of every policy, their impacts, and the consequences, intended or otherwise. We assess what the fiscal impact would be, or if there's a revenue element, what that might look like. Compare it to existing programs that are on the books, the QEM goals, the Quality Education Model goals, as well as state education plans and values, to assure that there's compatibility with those concepts to that.
And we determine the viability of any revenue sources that might be proposed to fund any fiscals that are associated with those programs or ideas. And also what impacts of funding or failure to fund but passage without funding means with respect to the commitments that we've already made in other service areas of education and how they might be impacted. And finally, we evaluate whether the idea advances our priorities as identified by the best practices in the quality education model and the achievement goals that are associated with those best practices. So here's what it looks like. As you can see, we've done this in a sense of, from our perspective, what our assumptions are about priorities for spending the first new dollar that comes in the door, as I mentioned before. Under column A, you'll see program restoration. We've gone through years of devastating cuts. You'll hear more about that from one of my colleagues in a moment. And so as our economy improves, or as new initiatives might come forward on the revenue side, what would be the best use of resources? Well, the very first thing we would expect are that vital services in the education sector be restored. So if we've lost all the music teachers at Reynolds, for example, at the elementary level, and all the PE teachers and all the counselors, you would expect that that district would have an interest in restoring those programs before moving forward with new hires for new programs or new initiatives. And so the second element, of course, is the best practices that are found inside the quality education model. We hear a lot, oh, quality education model, we've got sticker shock because the overall total for doing a biennial full appropriation per the constitutional ballot measure 1 passed in 2000 is out of reach. It was before the economic crisis. It's more so now. We're not talking about that. We're talking about the best practices that are found within it. That's how you get to the cost. It's the things that we know that work. Small class size, full-day kindergarten, extra staffing to help students who are struggling, supports for those kids, professional development, everything you've heard this morning, frankly. So those are the elements of the QEM, and so it seems to us if that's the state's best practices, if that's what's in the Education Act for the 21st century, we ought to make sure that our policy proposals that come forward align with those at the very least. We also have, under column C, new laws and mandates passed with a later phase-in date. A couple examples of those are increased minutes of physical education as a combat to childhood obesity, school nursing ratio improvements, because Oregon's is one of the worst in the nation, and the new graduation standards, which came to us through the State Board of Education's actions. Finally, you would take that concept through Section D, new ideas beyond the quality education model. This is not an argument about one partisan's idea versus another or about status quo versus innovation. We just say that if there's something that's new itself does not necessarily mean better, particularly if there's not a research basis for new. So innovation, to the extent that it is just new and different, may not meet column B. But maybe it does, or maybe it builds on it, or maybe it is based on research that shows new discoveries about how children learn better. Well, then, fine, if all these other things have come first, or if you have changed your policies in law otherwise, make sure that if there's a fiscal attached to it, that there's a funding source that's viable. So that's how we run through the policies. As you can see, you could do that with virtually any bill. This is how we structure it. With that, I'll turn it over to my colleague.
Good morning. For the record, Tricia Smith, Oregon School Employees Association. Thank you for having us here this morning. We offer this guidance to you because it is our guidance. It is how we look at education policy measures that come forward, the good ideas that come forward to improve our education system. We absolutely believe Oregon is spot on in what it takes to provide a quality education for all of our students. And it's contained in the quality education model. That was a model that was developed with lots of time, lots of expertise, lots of research and data about what works, and a lot of money, frankly, in putting it together and keeping it updated. And we would encourage you always to keep that as your filter for new ideas that come forward about how to improve K-12 schools. The model will work. All the data shows that it will work. What we have to do is put the components within the model into our schools. And the model is our guide to do that in kind of a systematic, well-thought-out way, so that we don't inadvertently or accidentally deviate from what we know to be the best practices for a quality education with a new idea that we haven't run through this filter to determine how it fits with everything else we do. Our quality education model is for us the true expression of caseload in K-12 education. We hear a lot in this building about caseload. Well, for K-12 we have caseload. We have nearly 600,000 students, and we have a model which tells us how to provide them the best education they could possibly receive. And then we have legislative sessions every year or two where everything else that ever came into someone's head may come into your committee as a legislative concept. So what we encourage you to do is to remember that the quality education model is based on best practices. It's based on the best expertise in the field about what children need in school in order to achieve the goals that the legislature and the state have said are important for our children to achieve in K-12. We expect and we hope that you won't ignore the model and the components within it when you are looking at these new ideas. That's why we offered you the framework that we use when we're looking at new ideas, because we are totally committed to the high-quality education promised by the quality education model, and we don't want to deviate from it. We're delighted to add to it, to build it, to put all the components in our schools that exist in the model, and then to address those things that are not in the model. But all of those things need to be sequenced properly and appropriately in order for us to truly provide for our kids what we've all promised them.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Hawkins from Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. I'm here today to share a little bit of perspective on the investment, or in many ways disinvestment, that we've made in education over the last several biennia. You heard earlier from Mary Alice Russell, president of the OASE group, it's COSA's superintendents group, about the vision and commitment that we are bringing forward in terms of continuing to improve education and student achievement as we move along, even in these challenging economic times. To implement that vision and hopefully our shared vision for that improvement will take an investment in education. And you have the document in front of you titled General Funded Lottery Spending by Major Program Area. This is a tool that we've used for the last couple of years just to give us some perspective on the investment that we're making in education and other sectors of state government. The left-hand side shows major program areas of the state budget, and as you can see, it tracks those across beginning in the 03-05 biennium and to the present day. You can see the changing share of the state budget that has gone to each of those program areas since 03-05, and across the bottom you can see the declining share, really the disinvestment in K-12 over that time in terms of the share of the of state resources going to K-12. Just to illustrate the impact of that decline, I want to share with you some results of a survey that we just completed along with the Oregon Association of School Business Officials in terms of jobs lost in education over the last 2 years. According to districts, and this was with about 110 districts responding, we've lost 9% of teaching jobs over the last 2 years, 8% of classified employee positions, and almost 10% of administrator positions in our schools. So we continue to have a commitment to do the very best work possible and continue to improve education for our kids in this state. And it's really important to us that that's a commitment that will never waver. But at the same time, we are challenged with fewer folks and fewer resources to get that done.
Good morning, Chairman Haas and members. I'm Tricia Yates with the Oregon School Boards Association, representing the 1,400 volunteer locally elected leaders in our state. Really appreciate the opportunity to address you today. We appreciate being able to present to you a framework that you may adopt that we find useful. You may find another organized or similar matrix with different assumptions, but the bottom line is we're seeking a common vision of best practices and high aspirations for all students. I think Senator Cruz said it very well earlier when you were talking about the full-day kindergarten initiative. You really don't want to treat some of these initiatives in isolation. Rather, you want to look at the entire system. We absolutely support that approach. And in talking about the quality education model, of course, the Quality Education Commission is meeting as we speak. Our president, Beth Giroux, is a part of that, and we urge you to really embrace the best practices involved in that model. Our districts around the state are talking about those as we all face the certain budgets that we're dealing with. So we urge you to use the good work that you have embraced in the past, and happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Very interesting questions. Questions? Senator Cruz?
No, I'm good.
Thank you.
Well, we thank you for coming forward and presenting this to us. Okay. We're going to move on to a higher higher ed presentation. Task force update, which will be a very formal and lengthy presentation. I think Senator Morris, you prepared a PowerPoint for us.
I did, but I left my home this morning without it.
Yeah. Really, all I wanted to do was to update the committee and others on where we are with this higher education task force. And we have met a couple of times, three or four times so far, and we are looking for my notes on this. We are looking at two or three more meetings. We're meeting again next week. We have been focusing a lot of our attention to a proposal by the university system to offer more autonomy to the universities. We have and will likely recommend a sort of a hybrid of that, I think it's fair to say. We will likely recommend legislation that will strengthen and promote this notion of dual credits in high schools. And we will hopefully recommend something that puts the 40-40-20 goal into statute. And we met on the OSU campus last time. We'll meet at Portland Community next week to hear from the University of Oregon. And Senator Morris, do you have anything to add about where we are, where you think we're headed?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think maybe the best way to comment would be to reflect the comments that I've had from Oregon State University, a genuine plea to allow higher education to manage their resources in ways that achieves greater outcomes, better outcomes, without the entanglements and the overlays that occur within the existing system that reduce efficiencies. And I hope that the legislature will look at that. You know, the comment was, you know, if this is what we have to work with, let us do it. Let us manage these monies, and we will commit to you what we're going to deliver. And so I'm looking forward to having the discussion when we get this formulated and recommend in a recommendation form. And hopefully the Assembly will give it thoughtful consideration.
We're working closely with the Western Interstate Higher Education Commission, and one of the things they reported to us is that Oregon's university system is the most regulated of any in the country, that universities are actually state agencies of ours, and they found that unusual. They also found it unusual, and Oregon is the only university system that separates community colleges and universities as well. Dana Richardson is our ABLE administrator for this committee. Do you have anything to add that we're missing here? No?
She's busy directing the legislature now.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Dana Richardson, Legislative Director for Senate President Peter Courtney. I did bring a visual, if you'd like it, talking about the concept of kind of a coordinating board. And as Senator Haas mentioned, we've been working with the organization WICHE about, you know, the state should, the idea I think that they're bringing forward is that the state sets the what. You know, here's what we want. We want high-achieving students coming out of affordable institutions. It's up to the institutions about how you do that. But they have come to us with an idea about how you bring in community colleges and four-year institutions underneath a coordinating board. I've got that kind of, just that spreadsheet up. I could throw it up here if you think it's helpful for kind of people to see that, or maybe it's premature. So I would, should we throw it up there? It's kind of small print, and I don't know if I know how to work this.
Well, while she's getting that ready, you've all got a copy of this Education Pays 2010 report that I find remarkable. It confirms what many of us have thought, that education pays, and not just for the student. We all know that. We've seen those charts where over a lifetime you can make $1 million more or all of those things. But it pays for taxpayers and for society. Welfare rates are lower, correction rates are lower, unemployment, health benefits, smoking rates are lower, unemployment, children of people who have access to higher education always perform better, and it goes on and on and on, and these add up to legitimate savings for state governments, and this is all documented very thoroughly in this report. So. You've all got a copy of it, and anybody who hears me here, we will give you the link to this because it really is remarkable, and it also makes an international comparison that I find is kind of a wake-up call for us, that the U.S. in 2007 ranked first in the percentage of adults with a bachelor's-type degree in the world. Today, we're seventh. And so if we're talking about the importance of a global economy for the next generation, I think that's a statistic we should understand and respond to.
So to kind of pick up on what this proposed structure is, and this is not, to be clear, something that the task force has recommended, necessarily will recommend, but it was an idea that was brought to them. And I think the idea that you see there with the, what are we calling it, the Higher Education Policy Board, is that the way I think about it is this is the legislature's kind of eyes and ears about the missions of the institutions, and what would happen is the institutions would bring their budget ideas up through the policy board, and so that the legislature would ultimately receive the recommendations in a coordinated fashion, but that they'd start at the institutions. So you can see, you know, there are the boxes for your four-year institutions, your two-year institutions, and OHSU. And please also note that there's no conversation around changing whether or not community colleges have local boards. There is discussion, I think there will be discussion around whether or not four-year institutions would have local governing boards, and if that's something the legislature would authorize. But I think that's pretty early on. So I just thought I'd throw that into the mix. You know, you get me up here.
I do. Thank you, Dana.
In the yeah. mix.
All right. Next task force meeting is a week from tomorrow. From there, we will probably have some legislation drafted that we decided on the task force will begin here in this committee. Okay. Any questions or comments before we adjourn?
You got new committee bills.
Okay, let's introduce our bills.
You got bills to introduce already?
Some motions.
He's got a few.
Oh.
Huh?
I haven't got any in my bag.
You want them out?
Yeah.
Are we into work session?
That's a short one. Put up a work session for purposes of introducing bills. Support or opposition doesn't mean support or opposition for the legislation, as you've all heard before.
Mr. Chair, I move LC 1291, dated 8/18/10, be introduced as a committee bill.
Do you want to read them all in one?
Do you want me to do all at once? Okay. Additionally, LC 1292, dated 9-14-10. LC 1434, dated 8-26-10. LC 1641, dated 9-22-10. LC 799, dated 9-22-10. I believe that's it, isn't it?
That is.
That all of them be introduced as committee bills.
Mayor Cruz moves that LCs 1291, 1292, 1434, 1641, and 1799 be introduced as committee bills. Any discussion? Objections? Seeing none, the measures will be introduced as committee bills of the Senate Education Committee. And I'll close the work session on the bill measure introduction. Any other comments?
Let's do this again in December.
Let's do it again. Thank you all. We are adjourned.
I see we